All right, we'll begin today with, as we always do, with prayer. This is an adapted version of the prayer of confession from Enlightened Confession in the Life of Spirit series. Oh, Heavenly Mother, Father, God, I sense your light and love within and about me. Though my attention is not always on you, I know in my heart that you are the source of my life and all good things for me. Without you, I can do nothing. With you, I am richly blessed with life, strength, wisdom, love, and courage. My human nature is sometimes weak and inadequate for my tasks. I need to add your light and love and will to my understanding, goodwill, dedication, and courage. I am aware of my many imperfections and of the times when I have fallen short of my ideals and standards. I often lack the wisdom to choose wisely and demonstrate the kindness, helpfulness, and strength that I might. Today, I'm in particular need of your help to tap and incorporate the wisdom of this class. I need your help and blessing. I seek to do these things both inwardly in thought and feeling and outwardly in speech and acts that are in harmony with your purpose and ideals of compassion and forgiveness toward all. I seek to express wisdom, goodwill, courage, and dignity insofar as I can. Bless me, O Lord, for I am truly your servant, and you are truly my partner in daily life. What is mine is yours, and what is yours I hold and trust to cherish as the light of my mind, the love of my heart, and the life of my whole being. May the God of love, who calls us all into his great peace and benevolence, hear my prayers and be with me and in me forever and ever. Amen. Okay, any comments about that? That's the model for confession we present in the essay. Confession is very important to keep us remembering that strength and love and wisdom come from the divine, and we need as much as we can get of it. Any comments? I'm sorry? Good. Anyone else?
I like the idea of that you're giving your all, and then you're receiving, and what you're receiving, you're cherishing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's to those who give, more will be given. And that's not just in terms of generosity, but as you invest your hard effort and labor and love in something, you are overshadowed, and more of those good things from heaven pour through you. So that's the key. The purpose of good acts or good deeds is that that's the way you expand your capacity to receive. Good. Anybody else commenting on that? Let's see. When there we go. Is that Judy? No. Is Judy with us yet? Mimi, would you give Judy a call and make sure she remembers that we start at 9, not 9:30? All right. You left your phone in San Francisco?
I did. Yeah.
Sorry to
hear. It's okay. I'll call Judy.
All right. Well, We'll take a moment of silence while we find out where Judy and Mary are. Any other comments while we're waiting?
She's calling in, Carl.
Okay, good.
Carl, she's calling in.
I heard you. That's fine. Great. Thank you. Okay, we go on to our discussion session then. I guess I can sound the gong. Our discussion today is going to be based on the line, the final line of Milton's poem On His Blindness, sonnet. The phrase, "They also serve who only stand and wait." What does this mean? They also serve who only stand and wait. Well, that's the way it's often been interpreted. Of course, this is a...
Okay, we're here now. Sorry.
Good.
Got a little bunch to do up front time
here. Uh-huh. We have just started our discussion, and our theme today is the line from the end of Milton's On His Blindness, "They also serve who only stand and wait." And the question is, this is a familiar phrase, what does it mean? How do we apply it?
Carl?
Yes.
Would a proper analogy be the biblical story of Mary and Martha, and Mary is devotional while Martha is concerned with practical things?
Well, you could certainly make, that's the great thing about poetry, is it's open to allegorical and metaphorical comparisons, and so you can certainly make a parallel here. Let me help out a little bit here. This is actually part of a quote from Patience. Now, I don't know whether Patience was one of his daughters, or we're talking about the muse of Patience, or what, but the ending of the sonnet is, "But Patience, he's been grumbling about his blindness." And the poem concludes, "But Patience, to prevent that murmur, soon replies." The whole rest of this is a quote. "God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly. Thousands at his bidding speed and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait." So that's Patience talking to Milton, who is agitated by his lack of capacity to involve himself in life. "God does not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait." Yes. I can hear you. But speak up, because you're kind of far away. Well, that would certainly be an interpretation.
Carl?
Yes.
Carl,
it sounds like to me. No matter what is going on, even when we're not expressing our best, we're still serving.
Okay.
So that's the impression I get. Everything. You know, he doesn't need, he wants us to do it, of course, but the plan is still moving forward. We're all serving. So that's the impression I got.
Okay, other input.
By being on the planet, we're serving God's plan.
Okay. All right. Would you care to elaborate on that?
Well, I thought that was fairly clear.
Okay, I guess you don't care to elaborate.
The God that in God is trying to expand and enlighten everything that exists. And we are little sparks of light, so that as we are moving around, we have the opportunity to spread our little bit of light and enlighten the planet a bit.
Okay. All right. That's a piece of the puzzle. A little spark. You mind if I call you Sparky in the future?
Oh, that would be perfectly all right.
Any of you have other ideas or insights?
Wasn't there sort
Carl,
of...
Carl, I'm thinking about our...
Yes, go ahead. Dorothy.
Okay. For those standing in wait, could that also mean for anyone who is not tuned with being part of God's plan, that that's okay, and they will come in time?
Okay, well, that certainly is an interesting concept. By focusing on the word wait, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in terms of in interacting with people in our daily lives, noticing that maybe someone isn't being their best, so it's in part us being patient with others,
okay,
as well as being patient with ourselves when we're not our best.
All right. Well, that's a good application. Rose?
I think this was from somewhere in the reappearance, but I'm not positive. I vaguely remember somewhere in there, it was the idea of the triangle, and there was actually like an avatar in the center of the triangle. No, he was standing and waiting. He was like overshadowing or protecting, but he has to stand there and wait until,
okay,
you know, we all,
there are moments of right timing,
planet or whatever.
Okay.
But, so there are always beings around that are maybe outposts protecting humanity, or
well, we can
and,
even take a
basically waiting and watching and, you know, being vigilant.
Well, even those beings who have graduated out of their animal stage but are not yet able to incarnate into the human stage because nobody's entering the human race right now, you could truthfully say they also serve and only stand and wait.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of the divine plan. They may not seem to, even those who, I mean, one way of interpreting this is it refers to spooks. They aren't involved in the in physical life right now, but they're doing more than just standing and waiting. That may seem to be that they're waiting their turn. Dear God, when is it my turn? But that's an illusion. Okay. We're getting some good ideas here. Yes. For sure. Absolutely. Standing and waiting are not, according to this, standing and waiting are not passive states. They're not states of inactivity, they're states of activity. Rose?
Well, then there would be the holy angelic kingdom from angel of a whole mountain range to the little nature spirits of a little flower.
To little pixies.
Little pixies, yes.
Yeah. Right. The angelic kingdom might seem to only stand and wait, but again, they're very, very busy. Okay, other insights. Let me read it again. And, yes, go ahead.
At the risk of using a military analogy.
Oh, please do.
There's a great line from a popular movie, A Few Good Men, where, you know, they're defending these Marines, and you know, the one defense attorney just doesn't like these guys, and says to the other defense attorney, why do you love them so much? And she said, because they stand on a wall and watch, and they say, you know, nothing will harm you on my watch this evening.
Uh-huh.
And they stand and wait and watch.
Okay. Good. Let me read it, the phrase from Patience again, and see if that expands your understanding any. God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. And Nancy's quite right. The traditional interpretation of this is that this was written during war, and he felt deprived because he couldn't be over there shooting and killing and maiming. But you certainly don't want a blind Marine. All right, well, to me, the key word here is who best bear his mild yoke. That's the heart of this. Because this is a poem about blindness. And so what Patience is telling Milton is, listen, the key to your service is your blindness. You're not, I don't want to hear any more belly aching out of you because you think that your blindness makes it difficult for you to do your work. It is the key to doing your work. It forces you to develop insight and intuition and your inner mind. And this is your mild yoke. The underlying implication here is that God's work emanates from the divine and finds expression in the physical. So, our own limitations, our own restrictions, there's no such thing as my work or your work or his work. Years and years ago, I asked one of my students if she wanted to participate in the group, and the answer was, well, you have your work, I have my work. And that was the end of it. I mean, never was in the group. And, you know, as long as you're thinking that way, in terms of physical plane activities, you can't understand the plan of God. You have to see the plan of God as, to put it in the terms of Poe's Eureka, it emanates from the central hub, goes out to the periphery, and comes back again. And so, yes, go ahead, Rose.
The way he phrased that, mild yoke, I think most people would think that's actually an oxymoron.
An oxymoron?
And yet it really puts it in perspective.
Well, you know, oxen's...
Yes, okay.
You got to yoke that oxymoron.
But, I mean, we shouldn't consider anything a burden or a limitation or...
That's right. That's exactly the point. Nothing that happens to us in our life, no illness, no loss of job, no blindness, no crippling activity, no handicap, is anything other than our mild yoke. And that gives us the key to serving him best. If we can overcome our mild yoke, remember Paul kept on referring to...
Kicking against a priest.
No, he did that. But yeah, he kept on referring to his some pain in the side or something.
Thorn.
The thorn in the side. And but he mentioned it, but he didn't complain about it. He said he accepted that gladly. And there was some kind of limitation. But if we view illness or the decrepitude of old age coming on or anything at all as an enemy, we miss the point. We can find a way. We're here to triumph over matter, to infuse matter with spirit. What better way to do that than by overcoming any obstacle that we consider to be an obstacle and recognizing that it's part of the divine plan and it's our work?
That's exactly what we need.
And as Rose just said, it's exactly what we need. A friend of ours, most of you probably don't know him, maybe none of you know him, but he died a few years ago. He was a Roman Catholic priest who then defrocked himself, got married, his wife died eventually, and he died about a year ago and of mouth cancer. And he couldn't talk or even swallow very well the last couple of years of his life. But as far as I can tell, he accepted that as a mild yoke to be borne. And I think he inspired a whole circle of people in how he handled that and kept busy and lived his life. This is often a way in which, in fact, what was happening was he was undergoing an initiation of renouncing the physical body and renouncing in the true spiritual sense, not in the sense of condemning it, but in leaving it behind. So whatever our yoke is, however we define it, that's a matter of perception. The key is to serve the divine plan. So, what does it mean to, well, let's talk a little bit more about the mild yoke of God.
Carl?
Yeah. Joanne?
I was thinking of a behavioral technique called time out. Many parents use it, some people use it in classrooms, where might say to a child who is distracted or acting out in some way, you know, why don't you take some time out and you have to separate yourself and really sit and think about your behavior or how you might handle that better. And I'm thinking that in this sense, maybe when we do have something that seems to stall us or hold us back, we're being asked to be patient and maybe to take some time out and to, you know, ponder on what the heck is going on, what does it mean, and or to deal, you know, with whatever is.
I think that should be called time in, don't you?
Right, it would be a much better. Check back in. Check
yes.
Back into the group to where, you know, how you could have been part of this or...
Realign yourself with the true origin. Okay. Anybody else? The mild yoke of God?
I have something that I have been in church recently about the yoke of God. And you're asked to put on the yoke of God. Often, as the priest mentioned it in church one day, I'm sure it's an emphasis. But he said that when they put the yoke of God around Austin, and so
And so it is light. It is he's helping us to walk and we're working in conjunction with him. So that's a nice image. It is light because of that. We're not as prepared for our own.
Okay, actually, that's good. That's but even that metaphor of the yoke around the oxen is one that arises out of the true meaning of yoke, which is to draw together. And it's the same root word as yoga. It comes from the same Indo-European source. The word yoga means to yoke. To draw together. And so you're quite correct that the true yoke is the yoga that joins the human personality with the soul. And in doing that, you serve the plan of God. You bring heaven to earth. Yes.
Behind him, kind of circle around his neck.
Right, the harness, the yoke. In the Six of Pentacles, of course, the horse is harnessed. Those are yokes. And they allow us to control the animal nature. But in a higher perspective, the soul controls the personality. Well, so what does it mean to stand and wait on God and God's plan? We've had some good comments. What about some more?
Well, there's a Yogananda quote. I don't know the whole thing, but it starts out something about being calmly active and actively calm.
Oh, that's good.
And so it seems like that's the state we should always try to be in.
Okay.
Being active, but not hysterical.
Right. Stand in this sense means to take a stance or a posture where you're poised and waiting upon right timing. But again, you see, this is a poem in which Milton is basically lamenting his inability to respond to the crises of his day. And this is saying not to worry. Don't focus on responding to what's going on outside of you in your life. Focus on standing and waiting in the light of God. So today, in our circumstance, with let's put it in the practical terms. The country's credit rating was downgraded by Standard & Poor's on Friday. There are two other services that haven't downgraded it yet, so it's one out of three. The stock market went crazy yesterday, probably still doing it today. It hasn't opened yet, but just about. The president came out in the middle of the afternoon to calm the nation. Did he deliver a useful message or not in terms of this poem?
Well, I believe the stock market dropped further after his speech, didn't it?
Right. The stock market collapsed another 250 points after he appeared.
I don't think it worked.
I'm sorry? Well, the drop was occurring. It had already gone down 400 points before he came out to talk, and then it dropped another 235. So the point is that I think that little snippet of activity yesterday demonstrated the exact opposite of what Milton is trying to express in this poem. And the statement, they also serve will only stand and wait. Yes.
Well, also, I believe he made people wait an extra hour.
Yes.
He was supposed to do it an hour early and just very...
Okay, well, this brings up an interesting question. What does the word wait in this poem mean? Here we... Well, all right. What else?
What? There's another poem that has a line about wait upon, I wait upon the Lord. Maybe it's from the Bible.
Well, what does that mean?
It's God's timing and not ours.
Why doesn't somebody go and look up the etymology of the word wait? I'll wait for you.
Off the top of my head, standing at the ready.
Now, can we look this up before, and it means to serve, wait upon the Lord?
Well, sure, it means to serve. The wait person brings you your food, takes your order and brings you your food. A lady in waiting is somebody that dresses the lady of the house. This is a meaning that has all but dropped out of our usage of the word, but it certainly was a common meaning of it when Milton wrote the poem. He isn't saying they also serve who only stand and await the right moment. He's saying they people who are busy doing what they can to improve things or doing their duties are waiting.
So calm the active.
Right.
I also think of the word, when I think of, see the word wait, I also think of the word attend.
Okay, attend. Very good.
Attend as an attend to or focus your attention on something.
That's very good. That it brings in the concept of stay focused in the source of this work. Don't get unraveled thinking about your own aches and pains. Keep yourself focused in the divine, that which sent you forth. God doth not need man's work or gifts. Now, that doesn't say that man's work or gifts are pointless or useless. Doesn't say that at all. It just means that our capacity to attend to God and the divine plan is what gives us the greatest, enables us to participate in the work of God. If we're off doing the rat race, the 9-to-5, which we have to do, but if there's a tremendous potential that we will get so absorbed in the day-to-day grind that we will forget all about the divine work. And we'll say, well, I'm just too busy. Wait until I retire. And we keep on pushing it off. So what he's suggesting here is all of the important things that go on earth emanate from God. They are designed to fulfill the plan of God. If we are busy working and attending to that, we will be drawing closer and closer to a partnership with him. If we get absorbed in our work, then we're detaching ourselves from God. We're separating ourselves from God. So how best do we integrate this patience, this voice of patience, into our personal and national thinking? Anybody?
I think it means that we have to pay attention to the right things, to, like you said, to the divine. Even when there are sort of seas of trouble swirling around us. I think, you know, I
this not just the sort of economic stuff, but just, I don't know, I just can't believe the total figure.
Well, that's the great conundrum. We wouldn't notice it except that he's in the limelight, in the spotlight.
Yes, he is.
Anyone else want to take a crack at this?
Well, it seems like humanity is actually going the opposite direction. I mean, we desperately need patience because whenever there's a crisis, we think it has to be solved 3 minutes ago.
Right.
And humanity is just like racing, and there is just a desperate need for patience. We're just running.
Isn't that an oxymoron, a desperate need for patience?
You know what I mean? Everything is so speeded up, and actually that is part of the plan, that humanity is being speeded up. Everything is, the
yeah.
energies and everything. But we haven't figured out how to balance them yet. We haven't figured out how to get that patience in there. We do it occasionally, but humanity as a whole.
So are you suggesting that the mild yoke is actually the skill of balance?
Balance.
Well, that's worth thinking about. Someone else had a contribution. Good. And that the Spirit of America does not share the same crisis mode that we tend to get into, certainly not the panic. One must assume that the sequence of events that have led us up to this point have been marshaled under the auspices of the Spirit of America to wake us up and to get us, as we the people, moving. So we have to cooperate with that and work in partnership with the Spirit of America. Yes, Rose.
So the group of people we refer to as, well, the will and genius of we the people is a group of people who are responding to the Spirit of America?
I would say so.
And you could think of each of those, each individual being a little point of light, being, you know, having the opportunity to be an agent of light for the reforms that the Spirit of America
right.
is directing.
Absolutely.
So you may not be Boehner, but you could be in your community or doing whatever you want or can, you know, have the opportunity. If it's just talking some sense into a friend or saying, you know, well, what about this? Or have you thought about that? I mean, there are all kinds of opportunities.
Sure. And we should focus on those opportunities rather than on the quote-unquote crisis. Okay. Very good. That's the end of that session. And so we're going to go on now to our discussion of the five stages of literacy. We've talked about reading the words and sentences on a page and comprehending the meaning of these words and reading between the lines. We did one each the first 3 days. Apprehending the subtler allegorical meanings that the words symbolize. Today, in this session, we're going to go where few men and women have gone before. We're going to talk about reading above the lines, reading the sublime message which inspired the writing in the first place. Now, this is not taught, reading above the lines is not taught in any school on the planet today, as far as I know. But it should be, and it will be in Walden Groves, not in first or second grade necessarily, but by the middle to the late elementary grades and then into junior high and high school, it will be taught reading above the line. This level of reading can be approached only if you understand my concept of above the mean. There's a veil that seems to divide life into two. There's life below the mean on Earth, and the life above the mean, which exists in the realms of the abstract and the invisible. This veil does not exist when looking at life from above the mean. There is no veil from above the mean, but it's almost impenetrable when viewed from below the mean. Until, of course, you learn to develop the inner insight, which allows you to escape into the realms above the mean. The mean, of course, that I'm referring to is the famous golden mean of Greece, the golden mean that inspired Greek architecture and mathematics and so on. When we read in Plato, for example, about ancient Atlantis, we are meant to interpret this as history, not imagination. We read about ancient Greece in who was the Greek historian, Herodotus, I think, and we accept that as the best guide we have to history, but when we get to Plato, well, that's an allegory. That's his imagination. That's a fantasy. There was no such thing as Atlantis. Well, whenever you run into somebody that refuses to accept the potential truth of Plato's report, they're not capable of thinking above the mean. They are stuck in the doubt below the mean. The mind that is moored beneath the mean. Oh, I like that. Beneath the mean. I think that could be a song. Beneath the golden mean. The mind that's stuck there can't conceive of it as history, and therefore must debunk or ignore it. The mind that's anchored in spirit, however, can easily grasp its truth and possibility. So, how do we teach young minds to read above the mean? I will solicit your ideas here.
By reading the above the mean column.
Okay, that's 14.
Number 14.
Well, okay, that's a good point. You earn an A for flattery there. Elaborate on that.
I think being open to ideas that are not prevalent, not in most writings or most conversations. So if someone is reading Plato, to keep an open mind. And if someone is able to connect with something like the above the mean column, be open to the ideas and ponder them.
Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
And, you know, those were just the few words. Those few words that can be written. So it seems that, you know, that would be a wonderful way that it's done to read about the moon and know that there's so much more. There's more to explode.
Okay. That's good, but why is that different than reading between the lines?
That's a different thing.
Okay.
Because reading between the lines, you know,
right. Yes.
I'm thinking of a comment that Louise made the other day about reading I Say Sunrise.
Right.
Now that Monday. And how she became aware of joy. And what joy was when she was reading it. And I think that's a great example of reading above the line.
All right. Well, that kind of answers the question I just posed to Mimi and completes her thought on the subject. Anytime you after reading a piece like I Say Sunrise or An Above the Mean or the On His Blindness, if you can summarize, if you can say, I was just struck by this divine force, then you're reading above the mean. If you're struck by, that's a very good answer. If you're struck by the joy of I Say Sunrise, and who can't be, you'd have to be dead not to be struck by it, then you're reading above the mean. And so that's a great example. Rose.
I don't know if this really fits, but if you read a book and these are just such new ideas, would that be reading above the mind or not exactly?
Not necessarily. It may just mean that you're learning new ideas. And so it could just be the stage of comprehension. Again, to use the example of The Secret Knowledge by David Mamet, as we read it, we might say, oh, that's a wonderful point. That really states it well. But it's not a new idea to us because we've had those thoughts all along. But it was a new idea to him,
mm-hmm.
and you can tell that he's tapping into the inner essence of conservative thought.
Well, my what I was reminded of was, oh my God, this must be 40 years ago. When I first read As a Man Thinketh. Now, this was before I took the class or knew any of this. And, I mean, I started reading it. I was given the book, and I started reading it when I got into bed. And, I mean, I finished the book, and I had to read it again. I was so, the ideas were so incredible.
Okay. Well, I think in that case, that is does involve reading above the mean.
You know, I never learned those ideas growing up or had
right.
any clue, and it was just so inspiring, I actually read it through again.
Well, it was a revelation to you, therefore mm-hmm. it does fit into the reading above the line. Let me take up Dorothy's suggestion here. I'm going to read you a recent column from Above the Mean. You've all read it, but I want to reread it just to illustrate the point. This is the one from last Thursday, Humanitarian Fog. In America, the heart of demagoguery is the government's capacity to spend money to court votes. The Constitution does not allow it, of course, but if it is cloaked in enough humanitarian fog, no one objects, and another precedent undermining the spirit of America is established. Suppose, for example, that a series of tornadoes wipes out three small cities in Upper Lower Dakota. The governor of Upper Lower calls the president, who immediately pledges the full faith and power of the U.S. to help replace Dakotans, to help displace Dakotans recover. If he does not take this action swiftly, in fact, the media immediately starts chastising him for being callous, cold, and asleep on his job. There's only one problem. The president has no constitutional authority to spend taxpayer money in this way. None. But, I hear you sputter, it happens all the time. It's what we expect government to do. You probably likewise sympathize with teenage boys and girls who protest Ah, gee, all the kids are doing it. But mom or pop refused to grant parental permission to go to a party. For the first 100 years of our existence as a nation, Congress was frequently tempted to allocate funds for relief purposes until one or another member pointed out that the Constitution did not allow it. The Honorable David Crockett did so a few years before heading out to the Alamo. As late as 1887, President Grover Cleveland vetoed an appropriation of $10,000 to help farmers in Texas suffering from an extended drought. In issuing the veto, Cleveland wrote, "I can find no warrant for such an appropriation in the Constitution. I do not believe that the power and duty of the general government ought to be extended to the relief of individual suffering, which is in no manner properly related to the public service or benefit. A prevalent tendency to disregard the limited mission of this power and duty should, I think, be steadily resisted, to the end that the lesson should be constantly enforced that though the people support the government should not support the people. The friendliness and charity of our fellow countrymen can always be relied on to relieve their fellow citizens in misfortune. This has been repeatedly and quite lately demonstrated. Federal aid in such cases encourages the expectation of paternal care on the part of the government and weakens the sturdiness of our national character, while it prevents the indulgence among our people of that kindly sentiment and conduct which strengthens the bonds of a common brotherhood." This kind of common sense integrity ended, of course, when the introduction of the income tax gave Congress unlimited means to spend taxpayer money any way it pleased. Suddenly, the Constitution and its limited focus were all but forgotten. Once out, it is hard to stuff a genie back in the bottle. The same is true for congressional habits that ignore the Constitution. We may all agree that Congress and the President have no authority to spend our money on allegedly humanitarian projects, which now embrace public broadcasting and Planned Parenthood and who knows what else. But how do we combat the humanitarian fog that seems to legitimize these acts of theft and malfeasance? First, we must realize that government is the least capable branch of society when it comes to administering humanitarian aid. Millions of dollars are channeled toward disaster relief each year, but most of it gets sucked up in supporting the bureaucracy that administers it. Comparatively little actually reaches the pockets of those who need to rebuild their lives. The corruption is even more apparent in aid attributed and distributed to foreign nations. But who, if not the government, will provide relief in the face of disaster? Who? Anyone other than the government. After Cleveland vetoed aid in 1887, private charities raised more than $100,000 to help the Texas farmers in need, 10 times what Congress had voted to spend. Is it humanitarian to steal from anyone in order to help the poor and downtrodden? The Constitution says no. The Ten Commandments echo, "Thou shalt not steal." God did not say, "Thou shalt not steal," except to allow the redistribution of wealth. The command is absolute. In our next election, we should ask every candidate for the House, Senate, and the presidency to sign a simple pledge. If elected, I will do my utmost to be an intelligent guardian of taxpayer funds and vote against all expenditures that are not clearly authorized by the Constitution. If any candidate should refuse to sign the pledge, they should not receive our votes. Many candidates will not take such a pledge seriously, of course, but signing it will put them on notice. Once elected, if they succumb to the fog of humanitarianism, or the hog of humanitarianism, in violation of the Constitution, they will be held accountable for this lapse of honesty in the next election. I'm a strong advocate of charity, intelligently and benevolently helping others who will benefit from it. But government is the wrong vehicle for a society to rely on to provide such help. Government aid dampens the spirit of generosity and subjects it to the constant threat of cronyism, corruption, and cupidity. Let us dispel the fog of humanitarianism now before it's too late. Okay. As I say, you're all familiar with that, but I wanted to illustrate my point here. What in this piece takes us above the mean? How do you read above the lines there? Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
As you started reading that, what came to me was authority. We have given the government the authority when we only have the authority spelled out in our Constitution.
institution. And I think above the line would be seeing that where does the authority come from? What have we as a nation?
Oh, an excellent point. That the whole discussion of authority is the above the mean element of this piece of writing. Yes, authority. What is the essence of authority? What is the origin of authority in our country? Is it the government or is it we the people? Is it the enormous tax base that they suck out of us or is it we the people? And of course, we all know that it's we the people. Liberals are trying, the left is trying to make it the state has the authority. But our basic constitution says that all that authority derives from the people and it comes from God. Good. Who else? The bigger picture. I mean, the above the mean.
The example you gave it was we the people who
right.
solved the problem.
Right.
So we have taken the idea of compassion, and that's another word that has just been destroyed. Compassion to the government is throwing money at it.
Right.
We'll solve it by throwing money. There isn't the concern about the actual problem and trying to solve the problem and heal whatever pain has been caused. It's just, well, we'll just throw money at it.
We threw money at Haiti after the...
Yeah, and they're still living in tents.
Yeah, exactly. And so, good. These are good points. The what takes us above the mean is the definition of the bigger picture influencing the point of discussion. In this case, it's the idea that anyone using other people's money has a moral and fiscal duty to use it responsibly, a duty to the spirit of America, in fact. So the factor in any piece of writing, written or unwritten, that leads us above the mean is the invocation of the bigger picture. And the way you teach reading above the lines is you ask students in discussing a piece of writing to define the bigger picture that the piece alludes to or invokes. And even bad writing may very well have a bigger picture behind it. So even if it's something that we don't normally think of as above the mean kind of material, a good teacher or alert students should be able to define the bigger picture that is there by its absence. Yes, Rose.
In the 2011 Tarot.
Right, the 2011 Tarot.
You have the first card, the Eight of Pentacles, the open window, mm-hmm. you describe as the interface between above the mean and below the mean. And
my God, am I prophetic?
I guess so.
Or pathetic.
I guess. And let's see, you say the major question of the year, are we ready to be about our Father's business? 2011 will awaken the need for humanitarian activity, not talking about the obvious feel-good stuff. How can society learn to be truly humanitarian, stimulating the best and brightest? And you said we would be going through this redefinition of humanitarian crisis for like the next 15 years. So I always in my meditations try to think about that idea and work on it and see how
good
humanity is.
Yeah. One more point on that particular issue of above the mean is the whole notion of humanitarian fog takes you above the mean because it conveys the point that compassion and all those things can be used to create a fog that obscures truth, not reveals it. So the bigger picture in any particular piece of writing or whatever, learning to read, could entail discussion of unintended consequences or a discussion of a divine law or principle or an inalienable right. did anybody, I mean, we learned in reading the Declaration of Independence that there were these inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Did anybody's education actually involve studying an inalienable right and what that meant and how it came from God? I don't remember it. It could entail a discussion of cause and effect or righteousness. I was impressed that in the secret knowledge, which of course we'll talk about this afternoon some more, but in the secret knowledge he referred to some Hebrew term of zadikati or something like that, and defined it as righteousness, and of course it was a derivative from the word zadeh, which we studied as the path 2 times ago, and that was the path of righteousness. So righteousness is not something, self-righteousness is a complete distortion and dilution of righteousness. Righteousness is something that you acquire as you tread the path of righteousness or zadeh in the mind of God. Also, you could talk about the purpose at work or the lessons being learned or what is the spiritual perspective on this. Yes, Rose.
Well, we're talking about reading above the lines.
Right.
You always teach us to go back to the root, whether it's a word or an issue or whatever.
Right.
And yet the educational system now wants to lop off. There's just too much history to teach.
Right.
It's too overwhelming to the children. They are lopping off their ability to go back to the roots.
Right. They're teaching beneath the mean.
Way.
Beneath the line. All right. Yes.
I was reminded as you were talking about the brilliance of shows like Babylon 5 and Star Trek, The Next Generation, and how they were able to deal with issues that affected humanity. And genuinely, the big picture and offer solutions as to possible intelligent ways to solve them by putting it in an alien environment.
Right. Absolutely.
And what a wonderful way that is to help people jump above the.
Yeah, even the original Star Trek often used that ploy very effectively by putting human problems in an alien environment. There's no question about that. The other thing is, if you remember, it's been a long, long time since A, we saw this, or B, we had to download this and watch it. The movie Creator
Peter O'Toole.
Peter O'Toole and... Mario Hemingway. And he would go up on the rooftop and talk about the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And he was constantly looking at the big picture, and then there was this scientist that was the villain of the piece who was constantly trying to deflate the big picture. And it's a perfect example of the war of ideas. Okay, now let me give you another example here. This is the fable, The Strength of the Lion, from The Hourglass, page 66.
Well, it's actually Leo.
Yeah, I picked it because it is Leo.
It is Leo.
No. Well, many primitive tribes believe that if a man kills an animal and eats of its flesh, he will inherit the strengths and virtues embodied in the beast. So it was in the ancient beginnings of time that a party of native tribesmen set out one day to hunt the lion. Each man was filled with the anticipation of being the one who would kill the lion and become kingly in heart and strength. On and on they marched, set on triumph, until they arrived at a grassy knoll frequented by the lions. The men hid in the bushes and waited until their prey arrived. Even then they did not move, waiting for the lion to lie down in the sun and fall asleep. Then they sprang forward, hurling their spears through the air. The lion was killed before he could move. The tribesmen returned to the village victorious, rejoicing in their kill. Yet not a one of them was transformed by the death of the lion. Not a one of them became kingly or virtuous. High in the heavens, however, a transformation did occur. A new constellation of stars was formed, the constellation of the lion. Ever since, the spirit of the lion has governed the transformation of men. Okay, how do you read that above the line? Go ahead. Rose?
The physical form doesn't have anything to do with the courage.
Okay.
But also what popped into mind was Darth Vader striking down Obi-Wan. It made him more powerful.
Okay.
The power wasn't in Obi-Wan's physical form.
Right.
It was all of spirit or of above the mean.
Okay. Anybody else?
It expresses through the form, but is not the form, I should say.
Right. Yes. Can you speak up? Okay. Anybody else? Yes. Okay, but in addition to that, you have to look to the skies in order to figure out what's going on. This is a parable or a fable of the big picture. It is of little importance to us whether these natives killed the lion or not. The real action is the transformation which occurs in the skies. And so this is very parallel to what we our talk this morning about. They also serve only stand and wait, that we are serving the plan of God by bearing his mild yoke. Life emerges from within. The meaning of life always lies in the stars, not in our actions. It's the type of approach that we normally don't get in our education. So, quickly, name some examples of literature that lead the reader above the mean. Judy mentioned, Babylon 5 and Star Trek and whatnot. Some other movies or novels or literature that lead the reader above the mean. Excalibur, why?
Why? Because it makes this wonderful myth. And you can imagine that you're seeing something totally frivolous or not frivolous, but that would have nothing to do with you. And in the end, everything that happens is something that will happen in your life.
Okay. Good. Well, you hit the nail right on the head with using the word myth. The whole curriculum of learning to read is based upon heavy usage of myths, fables, parables, proverbs, etc., in Walnut Grove, especially the myth, because nothing reveals the larger picture, the bigger picture, better than a good old myth. And so probably everybody that graduates from Walnut Grove will attend the University of Old Myths.
Old
men. What?
It's poetry as well.
Yes. Yes, poetry. I meant to include poetry. Anybody else? Other examples of literature, movies, etc.
I was thinking of the movie Cocoon.
Okay, Rose suggests Cocoon. Dorothy?
The autobiography of Benjamin Franklin.
Okay, why?
He actually cites, for example, the importance of convincing Bard to help understand wisdom and virtue in daily life and how to bring order to daily activities and focus on daily activities in conjunction with our focus on the divine.
Okay, very good.
It's pretty explicit.
Yeah.
You didn't have to read too much between the lines for that.
Carl?
Yes.
Mary and I just had a thorough moment of Harry Potter.
Harry Potter. Why? Why?
Oh, my golly. Pretty much the same reason as Excalibur, to my mind. I mean, he is talking about good and evil and the struggle that we will all have between good and evil and how to actually go to the good.
Okay. Very good.
You know, a real pathway toward spiritual growth.
Good.
I think also as a teaching tool for youngsters, the Harry Potter series demonstrates to them that even children can, you know, fight these battles and overcome evil. You know, they can display loyalty and dignity and courage in their behavior when they're struggling with, even with battles that children face.
Obviously,
in Harry Potter series, they're very
monumental
battles, but I just see that as
a teaching
tool for children to be able to. Oh, absolutely.
The curriculum.
Even though they're youngsters, you know.
Well, the plan for Walden Grove is that from the 6th grade through 12th grade, one of the novels is read every year by students in Walden Grove, starting in that 7 years, 6th through 12th grade.
Yeah. Cool.
Yes.
I particularly like the platform 9 3/4, where it's right
world. Right. There's all different kinds of things like that in Harry Potter that you can talk about and open the minds of young students to higher realities. Rose.
A couple of series. The Sword series by Duncan.
Yeah, Dave Duncan.
And then the Sword of Shannara books by Terry Brooks. I mean, there's like 7 or 8 of them.
Okay.
But they all have, the characters in those books all go through transformations.
Okay. Good. Anybody else?
Man of La Mancha.
Man of La Mancha. You mean Don Quixote?
Well, Man of La Mancha, yeah. The play Man of La Mancha and the book, but it incorporates, that play incorporates all of my favorite music, the poetry, a myth, an allegory,
sure.
And how theater is life. That, you know, that play encapsulates.
Okay, good. The
all of those things.
I'm very fond of the Man of La Mancha myself. I am even fonder of Don Quixote. Some other examples here, and there's no definitive thing, but any of these lead above the mean. I think The Greater Trumps by Charles Williams, absolutely brilliant. The novels of Joan Grant, the novels of Talbot Monday. Did I mention that we have one coming up, The Red Flame of Aaron Cora? The Mind Parasites by Colin Wilson.
Oh,
anything by William Shakespeare. Anything by Alexander Pope. The Ursine Trilogy by Ursula. Any of the science fiction, any good science fiction will serve that purpose. Childhood Zen by Arthur Clarke is a good example. But as Dorothy suggested, I think, let's not overlook nonfiction. The essays of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thoreau, the poetry of Wordsworth, Poe, Whitman, Dickinson, both Brownings, many, many others, all of these will introduce you to life above the mean. We need to touch the life above the mean on a regular basis in order to take advantage of spirit's capacity to nurture us. And the idea of stocking our mental pantries with the rich inspirations of heaven is one that should be imbued in every student's mind. The purpose of literature, the purpose of mythology, is, of course, to introduce people to thinking above the mean. Yes.
Would you say the test of the type of book you're talking about would be if you can read it again and
get
with each
more.
Reading you really get something more?
I think that's a good test. But also another good test is a piece of writing that you retreat to and read again when you need comfort or exaltation or courage. And that you can find those things by reading. The reading is a stepladder into life above the mean. Mm-hmm. So a great poem or whatever. Yes?
The Bible?
The Bible would certainly be right up there, numero uno. But not just the Bible, any holy scripture that endures. For example, the Bhagavad Gita in the Hindu tradition, the Tao in the Eastern Oriental tradition, although I prefer the Dao Miao. Good.
I was just going to say that as we read the Zodiac and go through there, there's always, I don't know, three or four books that what you're saying there refers you back to.
Right.
Like Beauty, you could reread Essay on Filling Life with Beauty. Or if it's the mind, there's the essays, The Mind and Its Uses, or there's the Enlightenment series. But there's just always several books that you can go and reread during that period, and it gives you that extra power or whatever to tap into because it fits in with the energy that's going on.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's time for a break. And it's 10:20. Let's be back at 10:30.